that the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning, and we'd like to welcome all of you to the third and final day of our October term here in the campus of Mount Marty College. We have several publications which you may wish to take advantage of that are available in the lobby. The light blue covered book is a synopsis of the cases we will be considering this term, which were given for argument. It also gives you short biographies of the justices. If you have particular interest in a case that you hear today, you may review the oral arguments later, which are now archived on our website, and that is listed on the back cover. Also, when the decision is issued in this case, the decision will be posted on that website, and you may also read it if you wish. Secondly, we have a light gray covered book called A Pictorial History of the South Dakota Supreme Court, newly updated a couple of weeks ago. And finally, a blue covered publication that in writing tells you how our system operates. The first case for oral argument this morning is the First Premier Bank as guardian ad litem of Daniel L. Boone versus Colcraft Enterprises. The appellant, First Premier Bank, Mr. Healy, you'll be presenting the argument this morning, sir. All right, and for the appellee, Colcraft Enterprises, it's my understanding that Mr. Marshall will do 15 minutes and Mr. Luce 5. Okay, who would be going first? Okay, and all right, that being so, Mr. Healy, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Your Honor, my name is Michael Healy, and I'm here today with my co-counsel, Mr. Raleigh Samp, and Mr. Jonathan Van Patten, representing Daniel Boone, who is an 11-month-old infant who suffered terrible burn injuries when the infant's playpen he was sleeping in caught fire and burned until his screams triggered a rescue. This is a product liability case that alleges a design defect. The defect which is being alleged is the failure of Colcraft Enterprises, the manufacturer of the playpen, to use a fire retardant chemical added into the polyurethane foam which formed the base of the playpen that Daniel was injured in. Recently, polyurethane foam has come to the forefront as being recognized as highly dangerous. The fire at the Station Club in Rhode Island, where 139 people were killed, has kind of brought that to our attention now. But Colcraft knew this as far back as 1991 when this playpen was manufactured. In fact, Colcraft knew at that time that the standard in the industry for manufacturing children's playpens that used polyurethane foam was to have that foam treated with a fire retardant additive. Colcraft knew that that was the law in the state of California as well. And in fact, Colcraft was making playpens with fire retardant additives at the same time, at the same plant, at the same assembly line, except they were shipping them to California and to the West Coast. The only difference between the playpens that were shipped here to the Midwest versus those that Colcraft was manufacturing and shipping to the coast were that the playpens here did not have fire retardant additives. But Colcraft didn't tell us. Colcraft was able to save between 12 and 25 cents per playpen by not using the fire retardants. And that information, the information about the absence of fire retardants, was never communicated to anybody here in the Midwest. Colcraft cut that corner for South Dakotans, they cut that corner for Peggy Boone, and they cut that corner for Daniel Boone. Instead, what Colcraft said and represented on the box was that their playpen exceeds all certification. The injuries in this case are admittedly serious, and for that reason, Colcraft adopted a policy or practice during trial of win at all costs. And this caused a variety of trial errors. It caused the trial judge to be lured down a path on a variety of different issues and make mistakes that deprived Daniel Boone of a fair trial in this case. I'd like to present these issues somewhat out of order because of some case law that has come out since the briefing that has been done. The first issue is the spoliation issue. As this court knows, there were two pieces of material that plaintiffs had in their possession, Mr. Samp had in his possession, that somehow became misplaced at the time of trial. The trial judge was convinced into giving an adverse inference instruction in spite of the complete absence of any facts supporting that instruction. The issue that was the primary focus was whether or not there existed or plaintiffs had to prove any intentional misconduct, any bad faith, or any malfeasance of any type. The plaintiff came out and argued the Reist decision, which clearly said that the intentional conduct must be present before the trial judge can give the adverse inference instruction. In this case, there was much testimony before the issues were presented to the jury, before the instruction was given, about whether or not that the having of these materials and then the not having of these materials was done intentionally. The judge specifically and squarely found that the absence of these materials now was not due to any type of bad faith, was not due to any type of negligence, was not due to any type of misconduct whatsoever. These findings are set forth in our brief specifically. Even the defense counsel admitted and acknowledged that it was not an issue of good faith. Everybody assumes and understood that Mr. Samp's storage under lock and key of these facilities was done in good faith.
Was this brought out to the jury and during the trial?
Unfortunately, it was not. The plaintiff requested of the judge that we be able to submit this testimony, that we allow Mr. Samp to take the stand and to explain to the jury that this had been kept under lock and key, and the trial court said that he was not going to have lawyers testifying in a case where they represented a party and prohibited us from presenting that evidence.
When did you make that request?
We made that request during the course of trial before the close of all the evidence.
It wasn't during the jury settlement instructions then?
Your Honor, we made this request repeatedly. From the moment that it appeared that the trial court was being lured down the wrong path, we made it again and again and again. There is citations in our brief which demonstrate the placement of these requests and the defendant's acknowledgement of these requests that were made. The key to the issue here, and as has been decided in Reist, as has been recently confirmed by this court in State versus Egesser, and again in State versus Boozman, is that there must be a showing of intentional misconduct or bad faith. The defendant, though, lured the trial judge down the path of thinking that if the evidence was in the possession of the plaintiff at one point in time, and currently is not in possession, that is enough in and of itself. And the trial court believed that statement of law.
Isn't that the court's holding in Matters versus Custer County?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Matters versus Custer County was an historical book that Custer County could not produce.
Well, the issue in this case is that the law in the state of South Dakota since Reist, and certainly since the court's most recent decisions on this issue, is that it must be some type of malfeasance or misfeasance or negligence at best, not nonfeasance. And what the defendant in this case argued was nonfeasance. There doesn't have to be any proving of fault at all. And that simply isn't the case. The adverse inference instruction is such a devastating and powerful instruction that this court, along with the majority of courts throughout the country, have required that the bad faith element first be satisfied by the judge. But the judge in this case simply said the long and the short of it, and those are his exact words, is that it was there at one time and it's not there now, and therefore he gave the instruction. That was
an error. To be made, though, between Hengesser and this case. Hengesser, the defense attorney, asked for an instruction that basically told the jury that they had to presume an adverse inference. In this case, as I read the instruction, the court is only telling the jury that they may draw an adverse inference. Is that the more neutral instruction?
theoretically, the instruction would be considered a neutral instruction, but when you couple that with the mere fact that before an instruction can be given, before any instruction can be given, there has to be a legitimate factual basis in the record. There has to be a preliminary finding by the trial judge to make sure that the bad faith or the intentional conduct, the negligent conduct, is in fact there in the first place. An instruction should not be given when it is not supported by the facts, when it is not supported by the law. That is simply inappropriate. And in this circumstance, it was inappropriate for the trial judge to give this instruction. It was devastating to the plaintiff because it permitted the defendant to argue that precisely what the adverse instruction is, which is, if it would have helped the plaintiff, you can bet that it would be here now.
Did they bring that up on closing argument?
In closing.
They argued to the jury?
They argued it to the jury, Your Honor. Yes, they did.
There is a big difference here between this case and Engesser. In that sense, there, the law enforcement officials, intentionally left a vehicle with or without evidence in it, in the open, uncovered. I mean, and that was an intentional act in the sense that they put it exactly where they wanted to put it, and they didn't cover it, and they didn't put it inside, away from the elements.
Well, precisely, Judge, in this case, what happened was the defense was given the opportunity to photograph, examine, and inspect these two materials, which, quite frankly, aren't relevant or don't impact anything anyways, but they were given that opportunity and took advantage of that opportunity in November or December of 1997. Then they were silent for 4 years. They never again requested that they come forward, inspect, and see this for 4 years' time. And suddenly, after it had been moved from one storage area because of some reorganization of Mr. Sam's law firms, the materials somehow inadvertently got misplaced, and they tried to bootstrap that into a jury instruction to give them an unfair advantage at trial, and that's exactly what happened. They had the opportunity to see this. So this case is even more egregious than Engesser, or in the Boosman case where the police vehicle was repaired without theoretically giving the other side enough opportunity to see it. We gave them the opportunity to see it. We gave them the opportunity to inspect it. They came, they photographed, they examined, and then they waited for 4 years. The instruction should not have been given.
Were the photographs ever produced at the trial then to the jury?
Yes, they were, Your Honor. And they were, the method that they were produced was shown to the defendant's experts and saying, here's the stuff that's missing, and boy, if you had this, wouldn't this make a difference? And in truth, the defendant's experts said, no, I've formed my opinions. They wouldn't make any difference to my opinions. And so another component of the adverse inference instruction, prejudice, is clearly absent because their expert gave all his adverse opinions regardless. He specifically said, it would not change my opinions. Again, the issue went square to the heart of liability. That is what the jury made the decision on. It was extraordinarily prejudicial to the plaintiff. That's why it's such a powerful and rarely used instruction. The next item I'd like to talk about is the admission by the trial judge of the careless smoking theory, or what I call the cigarette theory, of defendant's expert. The trial judge permitted, over our objection and over our motions in limine, the defense expert to testify that cigarettes could have been the cause of this fire. That is flatly incorrect under the Daubert standard, where any and all experts giving testimony at trial must first have some type of factual basis for their opinions, and they must follow scientific methodology in reaching their opinions. Neither of those events is here. The only evidence upon which defendant invented his cigarette theory is that the parents of this young man were both smokers and that there were cigarette butts found in ashtrays in the other room. There is zero evidence that anybody ever smoked in that bedroom at any time, and especially at the time of the fire in this case, or before the fire in this case.
Well, being in the next room, isn't that close enough? Do you have some case that says there has to be cigarette butts in the room where the fire occurred? Isn't that a jury call at that point?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because the reason is that there has to be a legitimate foundation for expert testimony so that experts don't get too far afield in their opinions. There's some very critical court decisions about being able to hire experts who work out of their garage like Mr. Worgen to testify about anything. And that's why the court has a gatekeeping function to make sure that things are proper and properly admitted and presented to the jury. And in this case, that didn't occur because the careful inspection by the fire inspector, Mr. Terry Flakes, a non-hired, non-retained expert, came in and excluded cigarettes as a potential cause of the fire because there was no cigarette butt found. Everybody testified, except, of course, defendant's expert, that a cigarette butt would have survived a small fire like this.
Just a minute, Father. If you have expert testimony that you've admitted that says cigarettes are not and could not be the source, then why does there need to be a Daubert Foundation for an expert to express a contrary opinion? You've already interjected that issue of presence or absence of cigarette butts. And as I read Mr. Worgen's testimony, he's simply saying that it can't be ruled out.
But he went further than that. The scientific methodology in this instance is set forth in the National Fire Prevention Association, NFPA 921, the quote-unquote Bible on fire and explosion investigation, actually authored in part by plaintiff's expert. And what that methodology says, and even defendant's expert agreed, is that if there isn't conclusive proof about the cause or origin of the fire, it must be held to be undetermined. And undetermined is, in fact, what the defendant's expert concluded. However, he didn't stop there. He went beyond that. He said that cigarettes could be the cause. Cigarettes might be the cause. Cigarettes may be the cause. And then the defense counsel preyed upon those statements, went into closing arguments, and took it a leap further by saying cigarettes probably were the cause. The bottom line is that this is a non-issue. It is the defense expert working from a conclusion to a premise.
The parents of the boy here testify they had never smoked in that room?
That they never smoked in that room. I don't recall any testimony that he did, that either parent ever smoked in that room.
Well, isn't it a fair supposition then that if they were smoking in the next room, they smoked in the bedroom? Unless they got on the stand and said, well, we didn't smoke in the boy's bedroom.
And to be clear, this bedroom was nothing other than a child's bedroom. Neither parents spent any time in there. This was purely a children's bedroom. This was not a place where the parent resided.
The parents had to put the child into the crib.
That is correct, Your Honor. And at the time, again, the facts are that the father picked the child up from the car, put him into the crib, and laid him down. And there is not one shred of evidence anywhere that the father was smoking at that time. It would be pure and utter speculation to presume that he was. It would be additional speculation to presume that somehow he spit out the cigarette in the center of the child's playpen. That just doesn't make any sense. It would be further speculation to presume that you would not be able to find the cigarette butt in this small, small fire. It is stacking of inferences that is simply inappropriate. These are the kinds of issues that Daubert and the court's gatekeeping function was precisely designed to eliminate.
Speculation or jury question?
It's inadequate scientific foundation. It's not a jury question. The jury should never hear that. It misleads the jury. It's the qualifications of an expert or the opinions of an expert without sufficient factual or scientific foundation.
Yes, while we're on smoking, let's take up the consideration of whether or not it was there for the trial court to permit the testimony in relation to the smoke alarm not being not having a battery or not being effective.
Exactly, Your Honor. This is the same type of issue with a little bit of a different spin on it, and it demonstrates the theme of defendant in this trial, which was to disparage the plaintiff at all costs. There was absolutely and utterly no testimony by anyone that the fire smoke detector, which did not have batteries in it, made any difference to anything or would have or could have made any difference if it had been functioning properly. There was zero evidence that it could have, would have, should have, might have even made a difference. For that reason, it is not relevant, but it is very prejudicial. The trial court erred in allowing that testimony to come in because very, very similar to the cigarette smoking theory. There simply wasn't any scientific evidence here. There wasn't any reason for it. There wasn't anything to tie it up. It's just taking shots at the plaintiff that aren't warranted. And it was a mistake to admit that testimony as well.
The lack of a smoke alarm, is that assumption of the risk or contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiffs?
Those defenses are not
a liability case?
Those are absolutely not defenses in a strict liability case. There's no question about it.
On what basis did the trial court let it in?
Under his discretionary authority, he thought it was somewhat probative. And in fact, it's not. It's without any type of causation, without anybody to come in and say,
it
would have went off. It's not probative. Your Honor, with 2 minutes left, let me briefly just address the opening statement issue. The mention of settlement intentionally violated an order of the court in limine saying don't do this. Our briefs set out the specific orders, their defense that there was no in order is just simply inaccurate. Again, this was extremely prejudicial. Another pot shot at the plaintiff that prejudiced Daniel Boone.
Intentionally violate the same rule?
Absolutely not, Judge. I did not violate one thing. Their complaint is that I talked about the California standard in my opening statement. I asked the trial judge, specifically for permission to talk about the California standard because you cannot explain this case without talking to it, and the judge granted that. That is precisely why, after my closing statement, the judge overruled the request of defendant for mistrial and sanctions and other things for violating that order. Here's in conclusion, Your Honor, the bottom line is that there was a double instruction. Remember that one? There was two instructions that were given on the definition of product defect. That was clearly erroneous. It was the risk utility test that ought to have been applied, which was not. There was subsequent remedial measures. He didn't let us get into that because he thought it would unduly delay the trial by 15 minutes. There was refusal to give limiting instructions on prior inconsistent statements. The bottom line is, the wheels came off this trial, and my client, Daniel Boone, did not get a fair trial.
Why was the separate settlement issue so damaging?
The evidence of settlement in a prior case left the false impression with the jury that Daniel Boone had received any type of substantial or significant compensation at all. It appeared to be a second greedy bite at the apple for a man whose medical bills had already been covered, which is the furthest thing from the truth. You will notice they never stated the amount of that settlement, only the fact of that settlement. It's the kind of thing that courts routinely indicate are prejudicial by their very mention, much like the presence or statement of insurance coverage or other things. You cannot unring that bell. It hurt bad.
When the trial court deferred the answer on that question, did you argue to him that it would be reversible error to allow it in?
With regard to the...
When the trial court ruled ahead of time that he wanted to see what the facts were before he was going to rule on that motion in limine, did you argue that it'd be reversible error if it was done?
We argued in our motion in limine that it should all be excluded, and under the law, the proper ruling was that it be excluded. I can't say that I specifically used the words reversible error, but certainly we advocated the position in the law that it would be improper to let it in.
Your time has expired, Mr. Healy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Marshall, you have 15 minutes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Mark Marshall. With me at council table is Mr. Mike Luce, Mr. Charlie Risch. Together we represent the defendant, Cole Craft Industries. As Mr. Healy said, this is an appeal from a products liability case. The entire theory of the plaintiff's case is a child was burned, therefore you must pay. They made calculated trial decisions that led to the state of the record on appeal. The bottom line in this case is clay yard made with treated foam burns no differently than a clay yard made with untreated foam. That's the sum and substance of what we have here today. With that, I'd like to address the plaintiff's arguments in order. First of all, I want to start with the spoliation issue. What the plaintiff failed to tell you is that Coalcraft made a motion for summary judgment on the basis of spoliation. In that motion, we filed a statement of undisputed material fact, as is required by the Second Circuit local rules. The plaintiff did not controvert any of those facts, and they stand admitted for the purpose of the motion. Judge Sertzka was troubled by the conduct. He was troubled by the conduct as it was defined by the Wiest case, and that is negligence is enough to allow an adverse inference instruction. It may not be enough to grant summary judgment, as spoliation is sometimes used in fire cases, because remnants of the fire are extremely important in establishing cause and origin. He didn't go that far. He didn't direct the jury to draw the inference. He instead simply allowed the jury to draw that inference. That's what distinguishes this case from Engesser and Bossom. We didn't seek, by the time we got to the jury, we weren't asking for summary judgment, we weren't asking for a conclusive presumption, we were asking only that the jury be instructed that such an inference may be drawn. Like Engesser, like Bossom, this court has told counsel that in cases where there is missing evidence, you are free to argue before the jury the inference. This instruction didn't prejudice the jury at all.
Mr. Schull, how can you give the instruction and then not give the plaintiff the opportunity to explain why the evidence is gone?
Well, the plaintiff
seems to me to be direct and indirect violation of the Wiest decision.
Your Honor, that request was not made. There is no record saying we want to present Mr. Samp's testimony to the jury.
Counsel just told us in oral argument it was.
Your Honor, I'm in the same position as the court is with regard to this. I wasn't at every day of the trial, and all I can suggest is you read the record to see what counsel said at that time. And it is Coalcraft's position that they simply never made the request of the trial court to present that testimony. I'd also like to share a couple more observations about spoliation, and that is, I believe this court changed the standard on spoliation when they decided Engesser. Under Wiest, I think that mere negligence is enough to support spoliation. Engesser requires a showing of intentional conduct. That is a substantive change in the law that can't be given retroactive application. And I'd also like to call the court's attention one more time to the fact that in our statement of undisputed material fact, we said they spoliated the evidence. So if you choose to give Engesser retroactive application, they never objected. They never controverted the fact that we claimed the evidence was spoliated, as this court.
Did the trial court find that there was negligence in losing these items or not producing these items?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that finding is inherent in the decision to give the instruction.
Well, did he make that finding? Mr. Healy says that the judge did make some findings that there wasn't any bad faith or misconduct.
I think the court found that there was a duty to preserve the evidence and that the plaintiff did not preserve that evidence and therefore breached the duty. Negligence.
He said that lack of possession was enough, and he said it was just nonfeasance. Are you nonfeasance? You're equating to negligence?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to move on to the cigarette theory, and first call the court's attention that it is the plaintiff who injected the entire concept of cigarette smoking into this trial by ruling it out. It is our obligation, representing our clients, to test the veracity of that testimony. And we can test that veracity by offering testimony of our own experts that they don't believe it, that they believe there is a possibility of it, although they never, Dr. Worgen never testified that that was the cause of the fire.
What did he base that testimony on then? What was the basis of that opinion that he gave?
Widespread evidence of negligent smoking throughout the house. There were photographs showing cigarettes extinguished on window ledges, overflowing ashtrays.
Anything in that room? In the child's room?
Your Honor, this was an extremely small apartment. Let me answer your question first. I don't believe there is direct evidence of smoking in that room. But given the size of the apartment, the amount of smoking, they were 1 to 2 pack-a-day smokers. They admitted smoking that day, both Mrs. Boone and Mr. Boone in their depositions. The discussion about finding a cigarette butt is also a ruse. There's no evidence in the record that these folks smoked filters. It is plausible that they smoked straights and that the entire cigarette would have been consumed. This is a matter of credibility, and it goes to the credibility of the plaintiff's experts. There was no abuse of discretion to allow vigorous cross-examination of those experts on this point.
Was there any evidence of the fire itself that would indicate that your expert would have based his opinion on, that would have indicated that it was started by a cigarette as opposed to something else?
The fire was a smoldering ignition. That is the kind of ignition that's associated with cigarettes.
How about the corresponding question in relation to the evidence relating to the smoke alarm not working? Do you agree that neither assumption of the risk or contributory negligence is a defense in a strict liability case?
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor, and the jury was so instructed. The evidence of the smoke detector was limited to a damage issue. There was a limiting instruction given, and the limiting instruction said, you're instructed that the evidence about the smoke detector in the Boone apartment is being received solely on the issue of whether an earlier warning of the fire may have reduced or prevented plaintiff's injuries. There's no prejudice from showing, according to Mr. Flakus, that a smoke detector may have. He gave that testimony in his deposition and backed away from it at trial. That was proper cross-examination of Inspector Flakus. Finally, I'd like to move to the discussion about opening statement. If you read pages 14 to 16 of the transcript from the motions in limine, and if you read Judge Sertzka's memorandum opinion, it is very clear that his rules were, you can talk about anything you want to in opening statement. You run the risk that I may eventually exclude that evidence, and you've breached your promise to the jury, but I'm not going to bar you from talking about any topic. He did admonish counsel to stick close to the statute governing opening statements and not talk about specific witnesses and what those witnesses would say.
Isn't it pretty clear that he was probably going to rule in that favor? I mean, why he didn't, I don't know, but that you couldn't mention settlement? I mean, that's probably... Everybody would agree that almost every judge in this state would rule that way.
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. I believe that evidence of other statements is admissible to show that a case was settled, but not how much was awarded in that case. And I think that's the rationale from Deegan v. Bayman.
What relevance would it have had to this case?
Thank you for asking that question, Your Honor. The relevance is not just the settlement, but the relevance is that in the course of that prior action, plaintiff's counsel alleged that the landlord's conduct, Jake Freddy's conduct, was the sole proximate cause, the sole proximate cause of Daniel's injuries. And I think if you allege that one thing is the sole proximate cause, there should be some consequences when you turn around and sue somebody else alleging that their conduct was the proximate cause. It's an issue that we were not allowed to get into because of the trial court's ruling. And I'd also like to go on and call the court's attention to how plaintiff preserved his record in this regard. At the conclusion of opening statements, the plaintiff did not ask for a mistrial. He asked for a sanction, and what he called the sanction was that his motion in limine be granted. Doesn't that suggest that that motion in limine had not been granted before? If it had been granted before, wouldn't one expect counsel to ask for a sanction that has some merit, some weight, some consequences? No, he simply said, because they did this, I want you to grant my motion in limine.
Let me ask you another question about these motions in limine. The whole idea is to have them ahead of the evidence coming in so that everybody knows what can be presented and what cannot be presented. My understanding in this case, that I know Judge Sirska says you can go ahead and do it, but isn't the motion in limine, shouldn't he have ruled on those items that he knew whether he's going to let them in or not?
Your Honor.
Obviously, then the motion in limine is to no effect. If you let it all come in and then rule after the fact, isn't there some error there in itself?
Well, first you have to allege and preserve that error for appeal, which I don't believe the plaintiff has done. Their objection is not that Judge Sirska failed to grant the motion in limine. And secondly, I wholeheartedly share what I sense is your frustration about how motion in limine practice worked. We asked the court, we begged the court to rule on those motions in limine so we could have exactly that kind of guidance. But we were left with the record as it exists before the court.
You have 2 minutes, Mr. Marshall.
Thank you, Your Honor. And had to deal with the rulings as they came. I think when you put this trial in perspective, two things become clear. One is the evidence is clear and uncontroverted that treated and untreated foam burn no differently in this application. The other thing that I believe is clear is that this was a case that was tried zealously, very zealously, for 18 days. This court has said, you're not entitled to a perfect trial, and indeed none of us is perfect, but you're entitled to a fair trial, and a fair trial is exactly what the parties received. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marr. Mr. Lewis, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Please, the court. I'm Mike Lewis on behalf of the appellee in this case. I will not try to repeat what Mr. Marshall has already indicated to the court. The main reason I wanted to preserve some time is since I was actively involved in the entire trial, if something came up, some questions about what happened at trial, I could address those perhaps better than Mark, and so that's why I reserved some time. Let me talk about a couple of things that different justices have asked questions about concerning some of these issues and what happened at trial. First, Justice Zinner, you asked with respect to the exfoliation about whether shouldn't he be given an opportunity, the other side, to present evidence to that jury, and wasn't that, as Mr. Healy has indicated to the court, wasn't that done in this case? I believe the record will reflect that the first time a request was made to present evidence was after both sides had rested during jury instruction settlement. What happened, I believe the record will reflect, what happened in jury settlement settlement of jury instructions was typical of what we've all experienced. There was first an informal session, and then we go on the record and settle it. It came up in the informal session, and then on the record, he indicated at that time, well, Judge, I'd like to present some evidence on this. It was very much within the court's discretion fact, I would argue it would be an abuse of discretion to do otherwise, and I'm not going to reopen and get into that now.
Would they have known? Did you know that he was going to give that instruction prior to settling it?
Yeah, there had been discussions about that instruction in the past when we had these in-camera discussions, hearings about spoliation.
Did the judge indicate that he was going to actually give that instruction, though, prior to the time you settled him?
No, in fact, we were proposing a stronger instruction, such as your recent case was critical of, and the court instead chose the pattern instruction, which just basically didn't tell the jury how to conclude that, but gave that jury discretion and made the jury the determination of that. Mr. Healy, on the record, then after the trial and everything, went before this court, and I believe it's part of this settled record, and tried to supplement the record later, claiming that I did make this motion before, but it's not part of the record, the reporter failed to take it down, and had a hearing on that, and Judge Sirska would not supplement the record. That, I believe, is the status of the record before this court on that issue of whether he asked to present that prior to the time of the settling of instructions. Obviously, there's things that have come up that I believe on a lot of these issues, we have to look at what the record shows. The recollections of counsel may be slightly different than what the record shows. And obviously on appeal, the burden of proof is to show on the record what errors were made by the court. And I would submit that the court had a lengthy trial.
You have 2 minutes, Mr. Lewis.
And it was a difficult trial. And as Mr. Marshall said, it was a vigorous trial. When Mr. Healy says that all these efforts by the defense was to disparage the plaintiff at any cost, is not correct. We had to respond to what they were claiming. This whole trial about this California standard, we were concerned that there was no proximate cause, that this fire that shot up flames with a small fire, it wasn't small. It didn't burn the house down, but it burned this child. It was a large flames that went up in the face and burned this child. Proximate cause was the big issue. Did the play yard, just because it had non-flame retardant foam, did that cause these burns, or did all of this other stuff that burned and part of the play yard burned in the fire itself? All of the evidence showed that with a vinyl cover, this non-retardant foam, whether it cost 20 cents or whatever, doesn't make a difference. The testing all showed that. 8 minutes with a Bunsen burner, you could barely get the pad started on fire with the vinyl cover. This shows that proximate cause was a vigorous issue, and the proximate cause dealt with all of these things that the defense talked about. And when Mr. Healy's experts say smoking had, we can rule that out, aren't we entitled to say, wait a minute, under a scientific test, how can you rule that out? Smoking causes 70% of the household fires. 70% of the fires like this are caused by smoking. How can you rule it out? Because we didn't find a cigarette butt. In a flame like this, a cigarette butt would burn up. This is what our expert said. Aren't we entitled to respond to that testimony? Aren't we entitled to not accept everything the plaintiff says and put up a defense? All of the arguments before the court on appeal seem to want to take the plaintiff's version of facts and seem to want to restrict the defense from bringing up these issues. The issue on the smoke detector, their own witness said, it would have made a difference. There was testimony, said that in his deposition, tried to back away from it. This all goes to that proximate cause issue.
Your time has expired, Mr. Lewis.
When you have eight, takes 8 minutes.
It has expired.
Okay. I'm sorry, thank you.
Mr. Healy, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Again, Your Honor.
I'd like to pick up where Mr. Luce left off. The one thing we apparently do know is that this child was not involved in the setting of the fire due to his young age. Aren't all possibilities entitled to be presented to the jury and then have them make a decision?
No. The only theories, the only evidence that can come forward through expert testimony is that evidence which is based upon a reasonable factual foundation and which passes scientific methodology. It must not be a far afield stacked upon inference upon stacked inference type of hypothesis that works from its conclusion to its premises, because that's the only defense.
Well, that put the defendant in a position of saying, well, we can't point to any specific causes probable, but there are many possibilities. Doesn't that leave the defendant basically defenseless?
Not at all, Judge. The cause of this fire was the playpen. It started on fire first. The fire inspector so held.
Right,
that's the fact.
The playpen had to have some source of ignition.
Right. Exactly, Your Honor.
Cigarette, whatever.
And imagine this. Imagine if the defense expert came in and said, well, it was a lightning strike. The window just happened to be open. A cloud happened to be passing by. A lightning strike is the true cause. Is the court going to let that kind of evidence in? Of course not. That's not part of any type of scientific methodology. That's the whole body of law that focuses in on expert evidence. And it is designed specifically to prevent, like I said, guys working out of their garage like Mr. Worgen from coming into a trial and inventing theories that support the defense strategy without having any good foundation or reason for it.
Mr. Healy, again, if there's a foundation for you and your experts to allow evidence that cigarettes were not the cause, then that same foundation has to be present for some other expert to come to an opposite conclusion.
It's not a
foundation. If the foundation is there for one, then it's got to be there for the other.
Not necessarily, because what we're saying is that there is no evidence of any type of cigarette, but the absence of the evidence is that it rules it out necessarily. There's a difference between coming in. That's like saying, and let me use my lightning example again. We can come in and say there's no evidence of a lightning strike, and so we can rule that out. There's no evidence of an electrical problem, so we can rule that out. That is a different set of opinions than coming forward and saying, yes, this could be it. Yes, this might be it. This may be it. And then arguing and closing argument, this is probably it. That is a completely different, that's an affirmative proposition that has to be supported. It's a different approach to proving an affirmative position of fact that you are submitting as the cause of an injury than when you come forward and say, well, listen, there was no lightning strike, there was no electrical, there was no cigarette butt, and that kind of thing. And so, again, even if it wasn't, let's just imagine that it wasn't, you still have to follow scientific methodology, and that methodology wasn't followed by the defense expert in this case. He started from the only conclusion that he could have, which the only way that Colcraft gets out of its causation argument is to convince the jury that the fire started inside the playpen and that something besides the polyurethane foam burned this child. The only way to get a fire inside and starting in the center of this playpen is by imagining a theory. You must start with a conclusion, which is there must have been a cigarette, and then you must move to your premise and stack inference and stack inference and stack inference until finally you can reach the outer bounds of some shred of factual evidence, which is the butts in the ashtray in the other room. That is not permitted. It's just not permitted under the law, not in South Dakota and not elsewhere. There is a limit to what an expert can do.
Well, then, taking your suggestions to their logical consequence, how do they defend themselves? They can't use the cigarettes. They can't use the smoke alarms. What do they do?
They can come in and argue that the damages aren't as severe as, you know, the evidence might suggest. I mean, the bottom line is...
Well, no, I'm talking liability, not damages.
Well,
how do they defend themselves from claim and liability under your theory?
They come in and they cross-examine our experts. They get an expert that perhaps can try and argue that, as they did, that the foam might not react in such a fashion under such circumstances. But the bottom line is, if they want to get an expert in there to testify in favor of the defense, I mean, I think it's clear that I think Terry Flakus is right. I think the fire inspector is right. The heater started the playpen on fire, and that's what burned. And sometimes that's just a fact. Sometimes somebody runs the red light, and you can't bring people in to say the light was green. If the light was red, you can't always bring people in to say the light was green. And when you bring in a hired expert to say the light was green, you know, there's got to be a cutting off of that. And regardless of what they might do in the next trial, the admission of that evidence in this trial was incredibly prejudicial to the plaintiff. Let me just touch on a couple other issues unless the court has more questions.
One more question. What about the comment now that Colcraft makes that treated and untreated foam does not burn any differently?
That's their argument. It's wrong. if you simply watch treated foam, I mean, the whole point of fire retardants is to stop the foam from igniting, and if it ignites, it self-extinguishes.
But limit this answer to treated foam in the vinyl pad as it existed in this playpen.
Right, and they are still wrong, because the untreated foam spreads the fire. Let's put this question in the framework. This issue is raised by the on the appellee's cross motion for appeal from the trial court's denial of their motion for a directed verdict. Therefore, the standard of review is the sufficiency of the evidence, and in evaluating that, the only thing that you look at are plaintiff's evidence. All defendant did in their motion was, instead of arguing the plaintiff's evidence as they are supposed to, they argued their case, tried to convince this court why they ought to have won, not why plaintiff had to lose. So that's the framework, and they've got it wrong. But the evidence that the plaintiff submitted is clearly sufficient to get the issue to the jury and to overcome a directed verdict. We presented evidence that the foam, the untreated foam, explosively burns, that the masonite board that it was sitting on burns, that fire retardants work, that you can put any amount of fire retardant, quite frankly, up to the point where it won't burn with a blowtorch into your foam if you so desire. That the California standard is a minimum standard, and our experts came in and said the burn patterns demonstrate specifically through scientific methodology that the foam was spreading the fire.
Since you have faulted all their potential defenses on liability, are you suggesting you're entitled to summary judgment on liability?
You know, we moved for summary judgment on liability, and the judge said it was a very close call and decided not to give it to us. But we definitely
think that's what you're suggesting today, aren't you?
Well, Judge, if this court were to enter summary judgment in our favor, of course we would think that would be a request. But we move that issue isn't one that we've raised on appeal, the denial of our motion for summary judgment. But we did move for summary judgment on liability.
Thank you.
And this is a good case where it ought to have been granted.
Speaking about issues on appeal, as I understand the record, you did not appeal from Judge Sirska's denial of your motion to supplement the record.
We did not. Here's the way that went down is when we started talking about this whole spoliation issue, we talked about how you would go about confronting and resisting this, presenting evidence and things like that, what Mr. Samp would have to do to come in and testify. And before the settlement of instructions, before the judge actually indicated that he was going to do this, but that he might do this because his conversation on the record was, well, I'm going to take it under advisement, we told him that, you know, well, then, Judge, if you do this, we're going to have to bring in lawyers to testify. And he said, lawyers will not testify in my courtroom. If you look at page 32 of the appellant's brief, we've cited the footnotes where defendants do not challenge that.
You have approximately a minute left, Mr. Yates.
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, it's difficult to cover all these issues in this time. You can tell that there's many complicated issues. You know, the instruction issue is a big issue. The blending of the two definitions, you know, we've cited the case that where it happened one other time, and they said it's clearly prejudicial. The bottom line is it was a complicated trial, but the judge was just lured down the wrong path and made numerous mistakes, and this boy did not get a fair trial. We didn't get the shake that he deserves in front of the jury. And we had a list of, you know, 30 different things that we had to pare down to appeal to this court, the ones that we thought were rock-solid appellate issues that would get Daniel Boone a new trial. The bottom line is, again, if you look at them singularly, they justify a new trial. If you look at them cumulatively, there is no question. This young boy didn't get a fair shake, and he ought to have done that, and he deserves that. And we're asking this court to grant him a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.